Today we have Life is Relationship. That was the title. Generally, one way to see the development of Krishnamurti's teachings, as he used to do it didactically in his talks, is that he starts sort of from the world, as it were, the social, the external, but then brings it, like we were saying yesterday, home. He's moving it closer and closer and closer. And relationship is somehow the next step. From the world looks like it's out there. We said we are the world, but it looks like something out there with which we are in continuous discussion and dialogue. But when it comes to relationship, it's much more difficult to distance oneself. I get the feeling that Krishnamurti is just cornering the self. It's just sort of, oh, I make my excuses. The people there are doing this. And then he says, all right, bring it home. How do you relate? And then he says, oh, it's me. So then I am at the center of the topic. Immediately, I cannot separate myself from relationship. I am in relationship. I am exposed in relationship. Relationship is what I do, where I exist. Now, these three words of the title for today of Life is Relationship, three little words, easily written, typed on a screen, put on a paper, said in words. But I think sometimes I just have the feeling that they really do represent a great depth of understanding. And somehow even I feel my mind doesn't quite grasp the full extent of those three words. Life, I mean, do I even understand that one? Is relationship and relationship. Therefore, he brings it again. I am therefore not separate from life. I'm not separate from relationship. And he added, usually, nothing exists or can exist in isolation. No isolation. And yet, that is what we experience. Somewhere there is already a dialectic, isn't it, in our life, between relationship, being in contact, knowing that our being, as human beings, is dependent on it, we're intrinsically rooted in relationship, shapes us, and we shape it. There is this back and forth, the non-separateness of our own existence. And yet, what we experience oftentimes is precisely the isolation in which apparently we cannot exist. So right there I see, I don't know if you see it also, a challenge. If we are in relationship, we're not isolated and we exist. But if the isolation, loneliness creeps in, as it does so often, and we have to look at that, then do I exist? Is there life? I feel that is dramatic. Again, maybe that's the Spanish tendency to dramatize everything. But the sense of that is the tragedy of life. We're facing the tragedy of mankind, that either we are in a relationship, we love, or we are not. The pursuit that we have this self-centered movement, which is inherently isolating. So we're going to go a little bit into that. That is one of the major issues that as human beings we naturally face. I think we're talking fairly generally, but I think if we were to pause a little bit and look at our own lives and see the trail of relationship, we would see that in operation of the love and the breakdown and the isolation. So what does it mean to relate? And if that is life, then what is our responsibility to that life? The quality of our relationship is the quality of our life. As simple as that, or am I overextending it? Now, as you know, Krishnamurti used to sort of make a little breakdown of relationship by its objects. So he would say, mention typically three or four things, like relationship with nature, relationship with things, relationship with people, and relationship with ideas. Now that's already quite a panorama to look at, right? I think that pretty much relationship with nature, we can see where it's at. There's always been our struggle as biological entities. Somehow nature is our enemy. We've been fighting it. We're born from it. It's our mother. It's, without it, we would not exist. Look at it. Relationship. We bring bread by nature. What does nature in fact mean? It means that which nurtures, which give birth to. Natura naturans is that which existing gives birth. We have been given birth by nature. That's our nature itself. I'm sorry about the language. It kind of wraps itself around itself. And sometimes you cannot make the right distinctions. But there we are. Nature as the ground of our very biological being. This monkey began millions of years ago as almost nothing. And yet slowly, through process of evolution, came to be this supposedly highly developed thinking being, capable of mastering nature itself. That's a major, major development. Did nature intend this? To create a creature that will master it? Of course, we don't master it, right? We are so confused and not so clear and intelligent about our relationship with nature that we're in the point of destroying it and therefore destroying ourselves, because we won't be able to make it without it, right? The order of nature is so much vaster than our calculations of self-interest. Our own survival is working against us. So right there, we have a big question over what's our relationship with nature. Evidently, somewhere, we have missed the true order, the true harmony of it. At the same time, we cannot also underestimate the danger involved in being an organic entity. Look at what just happened. If you believe that we had COVID and that this was really a threat, a pandemic, and we had to fight it. Now there is another thing coming, the monkeypox. So what next? There is all kinds of nature is also breeding all these things, apparently, whereby species can be wiped out. So we have to be careful here not to idealize that this fight is ongoing. At the same time, that we have to really respect the ground of order from which all life comes and by which it is sustained, and not to undermine it. If we do, we shoot ourselves in the foot, not to say somewhere more dangerous, in the head and the heart. We don't feel, we don't think properly. So we're going counter to ourselves. The spirit again of self-contradiction in which mankind, through his confusion, seems to be caught. So this is a question that we have with ourselves. Right now it's becoming more urgent and the whole world is aware, more or less, of it. And yet we're struggling with what to do. Knowing what to do, we won't do it because other interests are overriding it. So there we are. I have to look at what our interests are, what our broader vision is, because you need a very broad vision to have a right relationship with nature. You need to feel that you are that you are responsible for sustaining life, not your own only, but everything else, and that nature is not there for our use and exploitation, which is how we have conceived it, even from a religious point of view, right? You know the famous saying of God to people in the Garden of Eden, you know, I give you this garden for you to whatever, do whatever you want. Well, I'm afraid that was not a very good instruction to give if he did give it. He said, no, thou shalt respect all living beings because you are one of them and just as impermanent and fragile. I made you in my image, but images can be wiped out. Well, I'm putting myself in the place of God and I shouldn't. I don't know what God would say, but I think a modern God would say something different. Anyway, we made that move, right? To develop knowledge. That's the myth. In order to control the environment, but that knowledge itself gave us power. That power became our arrogance and our pride. And as you know from Greek tragedy, that brings in down the wrath of the gods. So we are there again in the Greek tragedy. Watch it. This is coming. The seas are rising and the heat is on. So that's relationship with nature. To really respect it, he said, to really not just have ideas about it, but actually contact it. So if you read Krishnamurti, you see what a close contact he had with nature, how sensitive his descriptions of nature are, how he says, I disappeared. The self disappears. The disappearance of the self, for him, of course, as you know, is central in everywhere. But even in relation to nature, that's so beautiful that the sensitivity itself and the fusion with the world as nature, as that which generates itself as life and existence, is also requires the vanishment of the self, the ending of self-interest. Eventually, he brings it all down to that, whether it is with people, with nature, with things, or with ideas. So bear that in mind. And what does might mean? Huh? Since we have to protect ourselves also. So we have to be a little selfish somewhere. That's the question. You say, aha, I have to protect myself against this virus, against this lion, against this hyena, against what have we not to protect ourselves? And yet, you must protect the lion against you. Look what we're doing, right? Killing lions for sport. That was one horrible development of history. You see it in the Mesopotamian kings. When you go to the museum, there you see them shooting the lion. And when you look at those bas reliefs, right, those carvings on stone, what is the beautiful thing there? Is the lion, is the horse, is the animal. And yet that beauty was insufficient to keep those kings from shooting those arrows. Huh? We override the real value of things as beauty, as the expression of creation for the sake of our power. When I go into the museums, and if they have a Mesopotamian section, I get a bit of a panic because of that sense of power overriding the value and beauty of life. So power is a dangerous thing when it comes to relationship with nature. And yet we need to have it in order to protect ourselves from all kinds of things. So you see, balance here, careful what we do with our power. And there I see it already from ancient times, in terms of killing was the way to show your power, to demonstrate your greatness. And that was its own mistake. Right? So that's one thing. Things, relationship with things. We live in a world of things, right? This is a material world with matter. We are matter. We're also objects. We depend. We eat every day. We have bookshelves full of knowledge. Matter even can hold knowledge. Look at that. And even beauty of some kind. So we live with objects. We need objects. We are moving matter. Look at this. What are we busy with most of our lives? And society is busy with moving matter, transforming matter from one place to the next. The industry, everything is a material, not everything. Most of it is a material process. Even information is a material process in terms of something that's stored in some material basis and then is transmitted through, again, energy or material waves. Well, if you call it matter, these waves, electromagnetic waves, that's not really quite, it's a bit shady there. But information is transmitted and held somewhere. Our brains, material. Thought, says Kay, is matter. Boy, what is not matter? A friend of mine used to make a joke. He said, what is matter? What is mind? Never matter. What is matter? Never mind. That doesn't matter, right? So matter and mind. But K extends the field of materialism in a way, hard thing to say about him, in terms of bringing matter to the brain and to the movement of thought itself. The world of things is the world of thought for him. He calls that reality. So we live in reality. In the world of things, reality, based on the Latin, res, meaning thing. So the word etymologically points to thing. Our relationship with things has also to do with thought. But watch, because we need things to support ourselves, to feel safe, food, clothes, shelter, and now we have other levels of necessity, like employment, like heavy, you know, all kinds of industry or kinds of production. I was just in Amsterdam today, because I give the course on Krishnamurti life there on the weekends, and I was coming in the tram. You know, Amsterdam has all these trams. So coming in the tram and just looking out at the streets, which is now beginning to be flooded with tourists. And what do you see? Shop after shop after shop. Cafe, cafe, restaurant, coffee shop, cafe, restaurant. This, that, the other. Things, the exchange of things, the pursuit of things, and the sensations that things provide. So what's our relationship with things? There is need and there is greed. the sense of the more is also part and parcel of our relationship to thing, and that they, maybe that's a factor of distortion, that we find it hard to draw the line as to where it is enough. When do I have what I need and I can let go of the more? Or is the more a necessity of our in endemic insecurity, our sense of impermanence? I seek security through my possessions, through having a bigger house, having more money, and so on, right? We seek security, which seems natural. But is this the way of security? The possession, the more. I once saw a little nature program. Nature teaches us a lot if we watch. And it was these cruel naturalists. I thought they did a cruel experiment on a seagull, of all creatures. They made a bigger wooden egg, exactly the same as the seagull's egg, but larger and wooden, and put it next to the nest of the seagull. And the seagull abandoned her real egg and went for the bigger one. Now, I thought, wait a minute, how far back does this sense of the more come from? Why would a seagull abandon her real egg, where life is, for a larger wooden egg that will never hatch? Is that what we're doing, metaphorically speaking? That the more, Krishnamurti used to say, the more is the enemy of the good. Because the good is what exactly fits the need. And the more is already an overextension, which necessitates going against the order of things, as in the seagull. That poor seagull somehow is it inbuilt in the animal to want something larger, something bigger? I left, that question has been hanging in my head, no? As to why we have this continuous drive for the more, which is the whole thing of progress, which is the whole thing of our Western civilization, which is now in jeopardy because of that very excess of desire, which is undermining the, well, is met by the limited resources of the planet itself, so that we cannot go on the more and the more and the more. So that has to be questioned. A relationship based on the more, on greed and not on need. And using things, why do we use things? Because we need them? Or because we want to become someone? Right? Things also have status attached. It has to do with my value as a person. We measure our values according to our possessions. So is that a measure of our worth? Money, status, and success have become, in our modern society, the measures of our worth. But is that the human worth? Or is that a transference to things and a value that things by themselves do not have? So there is a confusion of values in terms of what we are worth and what things are worth, and we equate them. Right? To have is to be. This famous equation that seems to be driving mankind to ever acquire more. They repeated this thing to me when I was a kid, And I couldn't understand it. I still can't. So they said in Spanish, they say, tanto tienes, tanto vales. You are worth, that your worth is as much as what you got, which is the same as English, right? To have is to be. They put it differently, but it's the same. Look how general it is. It goes, it is not peculiar to one culture only. And I bet you they say it like in different ways in different cultures. Maybe there are cultures that deny that equation, right? Maybe all Indian cultures in America and so on, they might not have had that idea that to possess is to be, and the value of your possessions is a measure of your worth. So again, relationship with things and what things mean to us becomes very important, because that's how we will use them. It depends on our values, right? Our relationship with people, boy, there we enter into, the other day I said to a friend of mine, because they were praising relationship and love and all that, and I said, don't you think it is a minefield? And they said, careful with that thought, because if you think that, then that's what it becomes. So, oh, quite right. So I better watch it. Better not put labels, better not undermine it, better not dismiss it. So they gave me, you know, were teaching me to be much more careful in the kind of statements I make, because that's an assumption, right? However, where was that coming from? That was coming from the experience of a series of relationships that went kaput. So you say, you know, our life, the history of our of our life is littered with the ruins of love. I went poetic. And I say, oh, watch it again, because that's too negative, you see. We want to maintain the beauty of love as we should, perhaps. And yet, when you try it and you love and it somehow turns into its opposite, how come? Until you become very skeptical, or some of us become skeptical at certain points, though not giving up on relationship, but not becoming cynical, right? Then you can become cynical. That's a danger. So watch it. But at the same time saying, well, there are serious issues here. Why is it that love, so beautiful in its beginning, so enfolding and warm, so free from any friction, so, yeah, it's like liberates you from your narrow little self, and you feel expanded, expansive, beauty is immediate, and yeah, you don't feel even your own old burdens of your preoccupations and personality glitches. It's like a balm of order and harmony and liberation, by all means. But apparently it only lasts 2 years, according to some calculations. So by the end of 2 years, the pink cloud begins to dissolve. And then what? Well, then the personality frictions begin to arise. Then they start to make kind of adjustments. Then one personality tries to change the other, and end up in a kind of conflict. There is dependence, there is attachment, there is possession, there is friction, and all that, and it can easily degenerate into incompatibilities, frictions, conflicts, and more violence. So the love turns into its opposite. Krishnamurti says, love has no opposite. So, all right, but you know, our experience would suggest that there is a kind of development from what we think love is, such that the opposite comes about. So how come is that? So when Kay looks at love, he says, let's look at what love is not. Maybe we made mistaken assumptions as to what love is, and that's why it was not love even in the beginning. Is that correct? Otherwise the opposite would not result if there was truly love. So there's a big question mark hanging over personal relationship, intimate relationship, in terms of what love means. And how come it easily seems to, well, after a time, it takes some time for it to develop. So it's also time. Kay says time comes into it, into the fragmentation and breakdown of relationship, because we build images of each other. This is his diagnosis. Is it that simple? I asked myself. How come my relationship breaks down with my wife Is it that I built an image about her and she built an image about me? And those images are not compatible? What is the image? The image is not, in the beginning, maybe it was also an image. It was a positive image. But the image turns into negative after a time. Is it that the image simply shifts, that it was always an image? If there was no image, and that's the basis of love, because we relate as people directly, love of an image is not love of the person. Right? I have a friend of mine from Denmark, and we were discussing this issue of relationship. And it looked like he was very skeptical about even the possibility of relationship. And I said, well, what are you saying? Are you saying that you don't believe in relationship? It sounds to me like you don't believe in relationship. And he said, oh, no. I believe in relationship. What matters is that I don't believe in the other person. So what is it that we are in love with, you see? With ourselves, with a sensation, and the other person is just a means to an end. Something like that he was suggesting. So he was sort of taking it for granted. I don't think he was that skeptical, actually. Rasmus, my friend Rasmus, he wasn't that skeptical. But he had this feeling that there is a gap between what we are pursuing and the fact that we have a living person there and not a fiction, not a fantasy, right? So the question of love and the real appreciation of another, the embracing of another as a whole. And I think Krishnamurti had another insight, which I valued very much and continue to value, dangerous as it is, but insightful also and helpful, that he said relationship is a mirror. Now, I say, that's where we are exposed. Intimate relationship, perhaps even more than any other. We are naked, not just physically, but psychologically. Everything that we are manifests in there. And therefore, look at how beautiful, I find that very insightful and beautiful. I say dangerous also because we may be afraid to be exposed. So if we have that duality already in us, relationship will expose us. And we may not want to see. But if we don't want to see, then we cannot really have a relationship, because relationship is its nature to expose us. Huh? So the love has to go so far that I'm willing to be exposed. Not by the other, but to expose myself, as I inevitably takes place in relationship. My aggression, my fear, my pain, my conditioning, my trauma, my ambition, my greed, my conniving, my lying, my whatnot is there. Think about it. I'm a liar, suppose. No, not really. But suppose I'm a liar, and I'm a compulsive liar. I say, I love you. Well, when I discover that, I wonder if you really love me. Do you love me? We are a liar. So maybe you're in it for some gain. You see, we're in it for gains, right? And for all kinds of things, not in relationship. There's always a means to an end. But is relationship a means to an end? Is life a means to an end? Because relationship is life. If you take it to that depth of understanding, then you see that relationship is not a means to an end. It's its own end. And besides, it has the quality, the possible, the potential of serving as a mirror in which to see oneself. Therefore, an extraordinary aid to self-knowledge, which is the way of freedom and transformation for mankind. So we are somehow not, I'm going to use the word use, which is dangerous, not using relationship properly. I don't say use, maybe not understanding relationship properly. That it is a mirror, that it is exposing us, that we are exposed. And isn't that important? Because we don't know ourselves. And that ignorance is what's undermining the very order of our lives. And therefore, relationship is like a school, is the school of life, in which my ignorance is exposed, my little habits, my contradictions, my what is not exposed. And do I want to see? If I want to see, then relationship also offers a potential deepening of self-understanding. And therefore, if it does offer that, and it offers a certain freedom, or the way of freedom in learning, from those conditionings that undermine and divide and conflict and contradict and break up, then it offers the real opportunity for love. Love being that quality of total harmony with what one is and what the other is. This self-transforming quality of awareness, which knows no division. That's practically a definition of love. But we draw the boundaries. I'll let you see this much, but not that much. And there are, depending on how divided we are from within, and there we have it, that we are divided, most of us, right? That's why we said yesterday also Krishnamurti's notion of the individual, that it is divided, and therefore not an individual. But if we are divided from within, that means also we are in a contradiction already with ourselves. We have an image of ourselves that we present as acceptable, and an image of ourselves that is not even acceptable to us. Therefore, if we seek the acceptance of others, and we consider that that's the meaning of love, we are necessarily bound to be hiding something. We are dual. We act in a dual way. But relationship, what does it do? It exposes whatever we hide. There's no way to hide. Life, you know, what is it? The truth will out. Relationship is the field in which truth wills out, itself out. But then I don't want to see it. So what do? Either I create another smoke screen, or I must destroy the relationship so I'm not exposed. And I seek a relationship in which it will not go that far to expose me. We also seek relationships for convenience, in as much as it won't disturb us to the depth that we need to be disturbed. Well, we're already disturbed, that's what I'm saying. But it won't bring that out necessarily. Won't bring out my contradictions. Maybe I hook up with somebody who has the same contradictions, and we just come to a détente, a quality of an arrangement whereby we just manage it. We tolerate each other's peculiarities because they are the same, and we carry on. We have a goal in common, security, or this, or that, or pleasure, and then we carry on. But that loses the depth. My feeling is that if relationship is not taken as that mirror in which self-understanding can be deepened, then after those 2 years is likely to collapse. This is the way, I feel, perhaps to give relationship depth. Because then what does that mean? It means that we are together in a much deeper and wider enterprise of transformation, of wholeness. The love of romance has its place, has its beauty, its energy, sexually too, and all that, the companionship and all that. But there is a depth to relationship, because it's like life wants to fulfill itself. Life wants to flower. And love may be the flower of love, of life and relationship. So that has to have depth, not the simple romantic, sensual aspect only, the sentimental element, but a quality of deepening self-understanding where wholeness can flower. If you like, love is the perfume of wholeness. And if we see that we are fragmented and our relationship exposes our fragmentation, our partiality, our narrow-mindedness, then it is important to bring that attention there, because it is being exposed. Therefore, we have the chance to see. I find that beautiful. I find that Kate really did add another dimension to relationship that we don't generally consider. And I think that has the potential to give depth to relationship, to love. Now, life is relationship. Nothing exists in isolation. But here we have it. Krishnamurti used to describe a kind of vicious circle of conflict, of self-contradiction in terms of relationship itself. We are, for example, afraid of loneliness. What is loneliness? So the question of loneliness, I used to think, why does Krishnamurti talk about loneliness so much? It's a little fleeting feeling. It hits you once in a while. Maybe while you're at a party, which you don't connect with anyone. Maybe when you're at home in the family, when there's conflict, and there's no way of bridging the gap. Maybe when just by yourself, and you don't feel that you belong in the world. There's so many ways of feeling alone, of, you know, being alone in a crowd. It doesn't matter how much noise they make, you don't feel connected. Loneliness as this awareness of one's isolation, of one's lack of relationship. That's a tremendous thing. So loneliness itself is pointing to that fact of our lack of relationship. So that's when I began to think, aha, so this is not a fleeting feeling only. It has depth to it. It is revealing something of the essence of the psychological structure. And therefore, it's very important to pay attention to loneliness. But what happens when we feel alone? We are afraid. It feels like pain. It feels like we're about to be annulled. If you're alone, you're not connected, and you feel you are not about to not to exist. So intrinsic to the sense of loneliness is the sense that relationship is what supports you in your being. And when you're alone, you are nothing. So there you are. You see, without you, I'm nothing. Isn't that the song? I love you. Stay with me forever, because without you, I'm nothing. So the dependence to counter the nothingness, which maybe we fear to be. So if you are lonely, the general movement has tended to be to move away from it, to move away from this gap, this abyss that loneliness points to, the isolation, the nothingness of the self. So what? How will we go away from loneliness? By seeking relationship. So move away from the feeling of emptiness and the fear of that emptiness, of the negation of myself, and go to relationship. Then I become attached to this person, because that person becomes very important to counter the feeling of pain and nothingness which is haunting me deep down. That very dependence, according to Krishnamurti, this is the kind of thing. I'm not saying it is true or not true. It's a description, I think, that he generally makes of a vicious circle in which we can get caught in relationship, which is loneliness, escape from loneliness. And Krishnamurti, as you know, was a tough master when it came to escapes. He said, no escape. We're all escape artists, but we are not managing to escape from anything. The more you escape, the more you remain in the same circuit of self-repeating contradiction. So careful with that. But this is what he describes, as I understand it. Loneliness, escape from loneliness, fear of the pain, escape from loneliness through relationship, so-called attachment, really. He calls it attachment. I have to hold on to someone or something. Is not only people, but also things, ideas. Ideas are very important here also. We feel lonely in terms of the universe itself, of not having any meaning, and therefore we want to give meaning to our lives by attaching ourselves to an idea. And we defend it with our lives also, because it's so important not to feel that anxiety in the face of not knowing. So, but take it to people, that attachment to people, that becomes possessiveness, dependence. He did not raise this thing, right, of wanting, depending on them, and therefore not letting go, possessing, dominating, controlling, therefore the friction, because the other person is not just an object, is also a free human being, have their own tendencies, and therefore the friction, the jealousy, the conflict, and the breakdown of the relationship. Back to loneliness, and back again. So where would you break this cycle? Right? I suppose at any point, right? At any point can be broken. It's all one turning wheel of misfortune. See, the wheel of misfortune. In terms of the relationship, right? I seek my happiness, but I'm actually escaping from myself. I used to wonder, you see, at one time I had this problem with myself, that I felt I was escaping from my loneliness by seeking relationship. through sexuality, companionship, the pleasure of it. Sharing a sunset with someone is so much more great than just watching the sunset by yourself. That sort of thing, you see? So the poetry of relationship comes in as a beautiful justification for this move. But I said, what is loneliness? And I didn't give Krishnamurti's answer to myself. I gave another answer, which was, this is important. See, Krishnamurti is posing questions for us to pose to ourselves. So I posed that question to myself. I said, what is my answer? And I felt that loneliness is the feeling that one cannot live with oneself. That's crazy, though. I said, what a crazy thing. We cannot live with ourselves. If we cannot live with ourselves, how can we live with another? So I challenged myself. And for 6 years, I avoided relationship deliberately. There was a bit of a torture initially. But eventually, I found that I could live with myself very happily. In fact, I was the happiest I had ever been. And I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why. But because I did not escape. So the sense of, if you want to find love, that's one suggestion. Face your loneliness. Face the loneliness is brought up by this movement of the self that is continuously self-isolating. That's where Krishnamurti brings it anyway. Self-isolating in his desires, in his usage of things, in his seeking his own fulfillment through any means whatsoever. But it's always self-isolating. It's always a self in the middle. It's always me. And when I hook onto another to satisfy that desire to escape from myself, I'm still me. I'm still in isolation. And in fact, isolating the other in significant ways. Okay, I used to say, we are separate becomers. Everybody's becoming themselves, fulfilling, reaching, achieving, satisfying. We're separate becomers in pleasure and fear. That's a huge indictment of the way we approach relationship and the gap that is there, right? He had also a joke one time, which I didn't initially understand. I think he had picked it up from somewhere. He said, when two egotists get married, what do you get? And he said, two egotists, meaning there's no marriage. Marriage means that you fuse, right? But the egotists cannot fuse. So when two egotists get married, it's still the same number. You don't get an egotist. You get two still. So I thought, that is the problem, isn't it? So the problem of separation, the problem of self-centeredness as undermining the very meaning of love is where he brings the fundamental question of relationship. And therefore, I will leave it there with a question. You know, what is really relationship? Therefore, what is required? What is the essence of it? And what's our approach to it? What's our feeling for it?